From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit's bankruptcy and water for 4 million customers.
This is a very high-stakes negotiation, and it's very important to note here that there are political implications for the counties with their own constituents in terms of how these negotiations play out.
A new report bears grim tidings for Michigan schools.
In our urban areas, our literacy rates are so low that we're compared to, you know, the least developed countries in Central America, if you can imagine that.
And what happened as World War II brought women, Southerners, and blacks into Detroit's assembly plants?
Where you see black workers in these plants, the companies were able to do it because they created segregated departments and segregated bathrooms. You might as well have been in Alabama.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Shipping season officially opened March 25th. Well, no surprise. Conditions on the Great Lakes are miserable. No commercial traffic has made it through the Soo Locks, and ice is still 4 feet thick in some places, particularly Lake Superior. And even though spring has officially sprung, icebreakers, with a little help from the Canadian Coast Guard, will likely be out chopping and breaking ice into May. On today's Stateside, we'll hear how the ice is delaying crucial shipments of coal and ore. I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, a conversation with State Representative Phil Cavanaugh on his plan for Wayne County as he seeks to replace Robert Ficano as executive. But first, Michigan's economy may be pulling itself up and out of the Great Recession, but Michigan's schools are still mired in an education recession, and all of the children are paying the price. That's the finding of the newest State of Michigan Education Report. It comes from the Education Trust Midwest. It's an eye-opening exercise to see how Michigan's schools and student performance compare with two states powering ahead in the national assessment, Massachusetts and Tennessee. So what lessons can Michigan learn from these two states? We're joined now by the co-author of this new education report, Amber Arellano of the Education Trust Midwest. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Well, I think the title of the report kind of says what you found, Stalled to Soaring. Tell us, in a sense, what did you find about Michigan schools and students?
This was really, I think, the most compelling and eye-opening evidence that we have seen to lead us to be able to say, yes, we are completely stalled. Our kids are either treading water, or many of them are falling dramatically behind states around the country. So, for example, we're now one of only six states in the nation that actually posted negative student growth in some subjects. That means our fourth grade students are learning at lower levels today than they did in 2003 in reading.
Well, I'm sure there is not a single teacher, principal, or parent who wants to see Michigan have that, be one of just six states to post learning losses in student performance in fourth grade reading since 2003. And as you say, that's one example. Why is achievement in Michigan so poor relative to other states?
Well, it looks like there's a couple things going on. One is that we've either been stagnant in terms of student growth for over the last decade, or we've actually fallen behind, so our kids are learning at lower levels than they were a decade ago. The other thing that's been happening is that there are states around the country that have been making major investments in public education in smart, research-based strategies that we know build teacher and school leaders' capacity to teach at higher levels. And for us to be able to do things like raising standards, raising expectations for learning and for kids, doing things like providing more equitable funding for our high-poverty communities, investing in things like extended day learning, especially in communities where we know kids are far behind and they need more time. They need more time with instructors to help them catch up with their middle-class peers. So it's that kind of mix in states like Massachusetts and Tennessee, but a growing number of states, really. I mean, we're now seeing major gains happening in New Jersey, in Florida, in Pennsylvania, and several other states around the country that have been really getting serious about improving their public education systems.
So the gap is growing, and Michigan is being left in the dust from what you can tell from the data.
Yeah, we're now in the bottom five states for student learning progress in fourth grade reading and math, and we're now at the bottom for almost all groups for our students, white, African-American, Latino, low income, higher income. I mean, we used to be an average state for education compared to other states. And I think many Michiganders take a lot of pride in our public education system. I know my family did when I was growing up here. And I think Michiganders in general really value public education. All the polls in the last year show that Michiganders are willing to invest more, but they want to see schools do better. And it seems like in Lansing, that conversation has been sort of stuck in some ways. You know, on one side of the aisle, we hear from people saying, you know, we need more accountability, we need better performance, we need schools to do better, and we're going to hold them accountable for doing that. On the other side of the aisle, we hear a lot that, you know, we need to spend more money, we need to invest more. And what Tennessee and Massachusetts tell us is that it's not an either or, it's a both and.
Mm.
We need to do both, that together by investing more, by building capacity, by investing strategically, and by holding schools accountable and educators accountable, we can really make dramatic improvement in as quickly as 3 to 5 years. So this is, I think, one of the things we wanted to highlight is that, like, we can do this. We really can do this. There's more than 2 decades of research and data. There's best practices in leading states around the country that we can learn from. The question is, do we have the political will, and do our leaders understand where Michiganders are at? Do our leaders understand how important public education is to our citizens? And I think it's really coming together as a state, across sectors, across the business community, across the K-12 community. That's what we need to do to really advance teaching and learning in Michigan.
Well, let's look at these two states you really focus on as far as getting it right when it comes to educating their children and, in essence, beating the pants off of what we're doing in Michigan. So let's first talk about Massachusetts, which, like Michigan, is a post-industrial state. Give us a sense of the challenges they faced in education and what they did right.
Yet, you know, they were in a place much like we are today in the early to mid-90s. The field, the educators, school leaders were really frustrated. They felt like the state had disinvested in public schools for many years. They weren't doing well. They had gone through 2 decades of plant closing. Remember, Massachusetts was a textile state.
Mm-hmm.
And they had many communities, many low-income communities, many people that were low-skilled and were relying on factory jobs that left for Asia and for the South, much like Michigan today. So there was a lot of frustration in the business community, too, that they weren't doing a very good job in their public schools, and they wanted more from educators, and they wanted more accountability. And so there was a grand bargain made at that time, and a consensus built around a roadmap to move them out of being subpar to where they are now today. Today, they're doing so well that if they were a country, they would be a top 6 country in the world. Compare that to Michigan, we are compared to developing countries, right? I mean, that's how low our achievement is. And in our urban areas, our literacy rates are so low that we're compared to, you know, the least developed countries in Central America, if you can imagine that. So there's a lot to learn from Massachusetts. I think the consensus built among student advocacy, among the parent groups, in the business community, in the K-12 community, and what it was going to take, and then the state really anteing up and saying, we understand that you need more capacity, we need more expertise, and we need to take our professionals in schools seriously. We need to value teaching, and we need to invest significantly more in that. Today, Massachusetts spend almost double in their pre-pupil funding than Michigan does.
And it's paying off in student achievement. And then Tennessee, as your report notes, it is not known as a great education state. In fact, it used to have lower achievement than Michigan, right there at the bottom of the country for years in student achievement. So what turned it around in Tennessee?
Over the last several years, there's been a lot of work to develop a consensus across sectors, again, much like Massachusetts, but there's been a great effort to really think about what do we need to do here. So there has been greater investment, particularly in state-level strategies and capacity building and educators' skills to be able to raise student learning for all of their kids. And as you know, we're about to go through this big transition in our state to what's called the Common Core State Standards, and that's an effort to make sure that all kids are college and career ready by the time they leave high school. We haven't even begun a state-provided training to make sure that all of our teachers are ready to make this transition next year. And it's a big one. We're moving from an old industrial model of teaching where we've emphasized things like memorization to a model where we're going to be emphasizing writing and analytical skills and problem solving. That's a different way of teaching. And what Massachusetts said is we're not going to tell our local schools, good luck. We're not going to say to them, good luck, try to do the same thing that you've always done, you know, but make it everything better, and we're not going to give you any more money or support to do that. They didn't do that. That's very risky, and that's the kind of thing that Michigan's been doing for years. What they said is that we know that we can do better. We're going to invest to make sure that we do it. We're going to do it in both in a targeted way and in a pupil funding way, and we're going to make sure that we bring up all of our teachers and school leaders' capacity to do better for our students.
It certainly seems that apart from the dollars and cents here in Michigan, there's a fundamental mindset that I can tell you feel is holding us back tremendously. How does that change?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, I think that conversations like this one are at the heart of that. There's a tremendous collective will to improve our public schools. I mean, the polls show that among parents and families, there's a great interest in Lansing to improve our schools. I mean, it's one of the reasons why, as you know, we see new bills on education popping up practically every month right now.
Right.
But the problem is it's about the how-to. There's a lot of confusion and a lot of questions about what the research really tells us work. There's a lot of confusion and questions about what do we know based on the data? What do we know based on best, you know, these leading states? And so this, what we're doing now is really an effort to really help build a consensus and help build awareness and expertise about what we know actually that actually works. State leadership makes a huge difference, though. I mean, none of the leading states have gotten where they are today without strong state leadership. And so, you know, rather than focus on all the things that we don't agree on, we're saying, let's focus on what we do agree on. Let's go forward on the strategies that we know work, that we can agree on, that we do agree on. Now we need the state legislature to invest in those strategies to make sure that we put them in place this summer.
The report is called Stalled to Soaring, Michigan's Path to Educational Recovery, the 2014 State of Michigan Education Report put together by the Education Trust Midwest. And we've been talking to the co-author, Amber Arellano. Amber, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's absolutely no question that Detroit and its automobile industry played a major role in the Allied victory over Germany and Japan in World War II. We've often heard Southeast Michigan proudly described as the arsenal of democracy. Not so well known and not so proud is the struggle that it took to turn the auto industry toward war production, particularly as women and African American workers stepped up to take their places on the assembly lines. We're joined now by Charles Hyde, Professor Emeritus of History at Wayne State University. His new book is Arsenal of Democracy, The American Automobile Industry in World War II. So good to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
To help us first understand just how vital the automaker's role was, can you give us an idea of just how flatly unprepared the United States was for war at the very time the war clouds were gathering over Europe and Japan?
We were totally unprepared. Franklin Roosevelt tried to convince Congress and the American people that war was coming and that we couldn't simply remain isolated from Europe. But his plea really fell on deaf ears for many, many years. It was in December of 1940, and that's a full year before Pearl Harbor, that he gave his fireside radio address in which he challenged the country to become the arsenal of democracy for the world and help defeat the Nazis and the Japanese. And so that's where the expression comes from. It was a speech he gave.
Mm. And when we think about who was leading the U.S. auto industry at the time, I'm sure it's safe to say that there was a fairly deep distrust of Roosevelt and his New Deal among these industrial leaders.
Well, of course, Henry Ford was still claimed to be a pacifist, and he was not at all sympathetic to the British since he was of Irish background himself. And Alfred Sloan, the head of General Motors, is alleged to have said he feared Roosevelt more than he feared Hitler.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow. But then December 7th, 1941 comes, and despite deep distrust and fearing, you know, Hitler more than, or fearing Roosevelt more than Hitler, everything changes after Pearl Harbor.
Exactly. Yep.
And so in a sense of, first of all, practically, they started losing the guys on the assembly line, didn't they?
Yes. In 1940, the total number of men and women in the military was only 500,000 people. By 1942, the military forces were 4 million, and by 1943, they were 9 million. And so basically what happened is that the traditional auto workers, young and middle-aged men, disappeared. They went off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And that left huge gaps in staffing, and what the auto industry did was to tap really several previously unused sources of labor, particularly black men and eventually, towards the end of the war, black women. Now, women had worked in the auto industry prior to the war. I didn't realize until I did my own research that in 1940, 8% of all the workers in the auto industry were women.
Hmm.
But at that time, only 4% were African Americans. And most of them worked for just a handful of companies, mainly Ford and Dodge and Briggs Body. And those African-American men were all concentrated in the foundries and the paint shops and the most unpleasant, unsafe jobs in all the factory.
So as they're looking around, the automakers realizing, okay, we're shifting to war production, everybody's very familiar. For example, a good example is Willow Run and how Henry Ford started rolling those bombers, heavy bombers, off the assembly line. So we know that not only the automakers but their suppliers had to change things up. They need workers. And as you pointed out, they brought, along with the African-American workers, white workers from the South. Do we have any idea, Charles, how many Southerners moved to Michigan for defense jobs?
Willow Run did a survey of all their workers and which states they came from. And if you include West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, and then other southern states, they accounted, I think, for something like one-third of all the Willow Run workers. So there was very heavy representation. There's a kind of story that was told that early in the war, a grammar school teacher had a fourth grade class, and she asked the class, how many states are there in the United States? Well, of course, at that time, there would have been 48.
Yes.
No Alaska or Hawaii. A little girl raised her hand and said, there's 46. And the teacher said, why are there only 46? And she said, because Kentucky and Tennessee are in Michigan.
Oh. And, you know, anybody who grew up in Southeast Michigan is real aware of folks with those close ties even today to family in Kentucky or family in Tennessee. And when Kentucky and Tennessee and these Southerners came into the plants here in Southeast Michigan, they brought their racial attitudes with them too, didn't they?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. And I think even the older immigrant workers felt threatened by African Americans, not strictly out of racism, but they were afraid the car companies would give African Americans their jobs because they could pay the African Americans less. And so it was really threatening the jobs of traditional Polish Americans, Italian Americans, you name it.
I'm speaking with Charles Hyde, who's a professor emeritus of history at Wayne State University, as we talk about his book, Arsenal of Democracy, The American Automobile Industry in World War II. And we have this sense of, you know, Kodachrome view of what was happening as those heavy bombers were rolling off the lines at Willow Run and the auto industry turned itself to the business of war production. And I think it would be surprising to most of us, and most people in 2014 would be taken aback at the depth of hate and racism that existed in those plants in our parents' or grandparents' day. You recount the fact that at the Packard plant in Detroit in June of 1943, it's so hard to wrap your mind around the fact that 25,000 white workers went on strike because three black workers were promoted to the assembly line?
Correct. By the way, that is part of the background for the Detroit race riots that took place in June of 1943, which is just another indication of how serious the racial problems were at that time.
And these hate strikes, so-called hate strikes, were they very frequent and common in the plants?
They were in some particular plants. The Packard plant seemed to have them going on all the time. You don't see them happening much at Willow Run, for example, or the Ford Rouge plant. A lot depended on the attitude of management towards these strikes. And in the case of Packard, they were really initiated by the local leadership of the local UAW organization within that plant, even though the United Automobile Workers were clearly against racism in any of its forms, or discrimination in any of its forms.
Well, I saw you had the quote in a meeting of union members as they were with UAW President R.J. Thomas. One white worker shouted, and I'll paraphrase his quote. I can't say it the way he said it, but he said, "I would rather see Hitler and Hirohito win than work with a black on the assembly line." And I can't say what he said. That is stunning to those of us living in 2014.
Well, and some of it comes from some very, very, very serious, deep-seated stereotypes about black workers. This is a delicate subject, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. Mm-hmm. There was a widespread belief that black workers, both men and women, were infested with venereal disease. And so one could not share toilets or even touch machinery that they had used without endangering yourself. And white workers widely believe this to be the case, even though there's no evidence whatsoever that it was true.
And that's why Chrysler made the black women who worked at the Jefferson Avenue Assembly Plant eat their lunch in the bathrooms.
Yes. Yeah. And where you see black workers in these plants, especially black women, the companies were able to do it because they created segregated departments and segregated bathrooms. You might as well have been in Alabama.
I think that is something that I just don't think a lot of us who grew up in Michigan really understood, that this racism was as deep here as it was in the deepest South.
Yeah, I was really shocked when I first started doing this research a few years ago. I had no clue that this was this deep-seated and serious.
Yeah.
But the hate strikes did eventually decline starting in late 1943, because finally the company management and the UAW and the military, which had all these contracts, said enough is enough. We cannot give up all of this production because of the racist attitudes of some of the local leaders in the plants. And they basically threatened to fire the workers that were involved. That would make them eligible to be drafted right away.
Okay.
There was a Hudson Naval Arsenal in Centerline, Michigan, and there the Navy officers threatened to draft the entire workforce, and then you would be under the control of the military, and if you disobeyed orders, you could go to jail.
So they really had to get tough, but I'm sure those kind of tactics may have stopped the hate strikes, but it didn't take care of the inherent racism.
No, absolutely not. I think white workers finally just accepted that there were going to be black workers in their factories. They just stayed away from them, and so you had black workers, but they were in very segregated work areas.
So was this the status quo then? This mutually assured destruction, if you will, until up to the end of the war. That was kind of the way it was. So the war ends, and the men muster out of the military, and they start coming home. What becomes of these workers brought into the war effort? Did the groups fare differently between women, African Americans, and Southern whites?
Well, some of the African Americans did a little bit better. Part of what happened is part of the general understanding between the military and the government and the union and the employers is that there was a promise made to the servicemen that went off to war, whether they were drafted or volunteered, that their jobs would be available for them when they returned. And the important thing in those auto plants, which were now all unionized, was your seniority.
Sure.
Well, if you had 3 or 4 years seniority when you went into the service and you were in there for 3 years, you earned 3 more years of seniority. So you came back with 7 years, which meant you bumped almost every woman who had been hired during the war and most of the African Americans. They would lose their jobs to these white servicemen who were coming back. So while you had at one point almost a quarter of all the workers in these war plants were women in, say, 1944, mm-hmm. when you get into 1947 or 48, it's back to about 7%.
And those women, we've talked to some of the Rosie the Riveters who said we would have been very happy to keep on working.
Yeah, the company management and the military tried to spread this myth that, well, these women really don't want to stay in these jobs. They really want to, you know, when their husband comes home, or if they're not married, they want to find a husband and get married and have a bunch of kids, and that's it. Well, right at the end of the war, the U.S. Bureau of Labor did a survey of all these women war workers, and guess what? About 80% said they really would have preferred to stay at their factory jobs. And for good reason, when you think about it, these were very well-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. By comparison, if you were a woman in the workforce before the war, you didn't have a lot of choices. You might become a school teacher, which was poorly paid. You might mm-hmm. become a nurse, which was a little better paid. And then what were the other options? Waitress, seamstress, housekeeper. These were all low-paid, lousy jobs. And so most women would have stayed at the plants if they'd had a choice.
Why isn't this side of the war effort better known, Charles?
I'm convinced that the wartime experience, particularly of women, opened up the gates for the women's movement in the 1960s and women coming back into the auto plants and other places. It sowed some seeds for future advance. I think it took a long time for those seeds to take root and flower. But a couple of things happened, even male managers are not entirely stupid about everything. One of the things they learned is that women could do almost every job that a man could do. They were competent. They were probably more careful and honest than the average man in the plants. They were, you know, physically able, dexterous, and all of that. They were good workers. And so whatever mythology you had about women's weaknesses, you know, the weaker sex, if you had your eyes open, you had to throw those misconceptions out the window. And on the other hand, women also learned they could do this stuff as well as men. And they could earn a nice paycheck and the freedom that comes with that. And I would guess that a lot of those women who did go back home did a lot of different things to encourage their daughters to be more independent.
And then you think about 20 years later, there they came.
You got it, absolutely. And I can't prove this.
Sure.
I'm convinced this was part of the social changes that took place. And the same with African Americans, too. They also learned that they could do these jobs and not just the worst jobs in the foundries, that they could do skilled machine work and all the rest.
But how long did it take for management and union leaders, local leaders, to accept them there?
Well, I think, you know, it finally happened in the 70s, actually. We begin to see within just a very short window the share of women jumping from like 8% up to 20%. And I think today in the auto plants, women are about one-third of all the workers. It just took, and I think, you know, Title IX may have had something to do with it, I think the women's movement had a lot to do with it, saying, you know, you can't just keep dismissing people because of their gender. You've got to give them a chance to do these jobs.
And at the same time, we had the civil rights movement saying the same thing. You can't dismiss people because of the color of their skin.
Absolutely.
We know history is a great teacher. And I'm wondering, when we think of the 70 years between then and now, can we look at what happened then and can we state there is good news here? We have made much progress since those hate strikes of the 1940s. Or is that racism alive but buried deep below the surface?
Well, I think there's still some of it in some areas, but there has clearly been significant changes in accepting both African Americans and women as co-workers, as fellow workers. But it's come very, very slowly, and I think World War II was kind of a pushing point to finally start bringing those changes.
It's a fascinating book, Charles Hyde's book, Arsenal of Democracy, The American Automobile Industry in World War II. It's an eye-opener. He's a professor emeritus of history at Wayne State University. I would love to sit in one of your history classes. I could tell you make it come alive.
Well, thank you very much. I try to.
Thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Okay, very good. Thank you again. Now, bye-bye.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He has been a county commissioner. He's currently in his second term as the state representative for Redford Township, the 10th House District. And now, Phil Cavanaugh wants to become the next Wayne County executive. Representative, what compelled you to enter this race and want to replace Robert Ficano as county exec?
The need. I think the county has completely lost its focus on the constituents and the people we deliver services for.
Certainly, financial issues are a big problem in Wayne County. The B word has been tossed around even. Do you think bankruptcy could actually be a possibility for Wayne County?
Well, a few months back, I convened a panel of experts, and it was the former state treasurer, Robert Klein, budget director, a economist from University of Michigan, and they said there is a crisis, a financial crisis in Wayne County. And by many benchmarks, the governor should have and could have come into Wayne County before Detroit with an emergency manager and eventually a bankruptcy. I think that if we make the tough decisions right now, we could save that off. We just need politicians and the administration to have the courage to do such.
Certainly, there are no shortage of headlines regarding current Wayne County, except Robert Ficano with criminal convictions of four of his former aides on federal crimes related to that bribery probe, and reports the feds are continuing that probe, although we will note here that Robert Ficano has repeatedly said he has done nothing wrong and he has not been charged with any crimes. But what do you think all of this has done to perceptions of Wayne County throughout Michigan and beyond?
That is exactly it. We just went through a terrible era in Detroit's history with the conviction of a mayor and the resignation of a sitting mayor. Now to have the FBI in Wayne County, I don't know whether the actions of some of his staff has gotten how high up it's gotten, but I think it's not the point. The point is people have lost faith in government. We need somebody to have the respect at the state and federal level, because these problems are more than Wayne County's budget can handle right now. And I'm not asking for a bailout, but there has to be communication and how we can share resources. And I think that's the only way that we get back on our footing in Wayne County.
Let's talk about the budget, if we can, Representative. Wayne County's budget deficit is figured to be around $175 million, and then the unfunded pension liabilities around $825 million. What do you want to do, and what do you think you can do to address these problems?
First and foremost is changing the attitude. I mean, I was a Wayne County commissioner from 01 to 08. While I was there, the administration would just dictate to the prosecutor, the sheriff, the clerk, the treasurer, the commission, et cetera, this is your budget. And lo and behold, nearly every year, either the sheriff, the prosecutor, the courts were suing the executive. That is a problem. I mean, changing the culture and saying that we're all in this together, we need to figure this out together. And I think that our criminal justice system has severely been hampered by this. So what can be done? The pension system is 47% funded. It did earn 18% last year because the market was so stellar. But we do need to look at restructuring not just benefits, but how Wayne County does business. Right now we're in this no man's land that nobody wants to touch Wayne County. The budget deficit itself, it's a structural deficit. The latest deficit elimination plan, I think, just screams at incompetency and the chaos that's really there. So I don't have any silver bullet answers, but I do know the culture needs to be changed. I have dealt with the Wayne County budget for 8 years. I've dealt with state budgets, and I can dig to the bottom. And it's to be more inclusive with people, to put as many people at the table instead of I'm the smartest guy in the room.
Now, we've got Westland Mayor William Wild running for county executive, as well as County Commissioner Kevin McNamara. And we were hearing some noises from former Detroit Mayor Dave Bing last year saying he was thinking of running for executive. And what do you bring to Wayne County that these others don't?
I absolutely bring the fact that I have not just relationships, but knowledge on how county government works, how state government works. I have tackled and balanced budgets at both levels and know our congressional and senators at the federal level very well. So first and foremost, I bring relationships. Also, I bring knowledge of how the county functions. But my thinking is the change of culture. You know, I'm seeing a lot of people on these other two campaign staffs that are the same recycled people. And we need to change the paradigm. We need to change thinking. By me just saying that I want to bring integrity to government isn't the end-all be-all. Every politician says that. I want to prove it, much like my father did when he was elected mayor in 1961.
In fact, we should note your father, Jerome Cavanaugh, was Detroit's mayor from 1962 to 1970. And I was wondering how your family history and your legacy play into your candidacy and into your politics.
Well, I think that a lot of people that vote, the senior vote, is remembering my father very fondly and the things that he did for civil rights. I raised my children, and I was raised always hearing about the legacy of my father. I was only 18 when he died in 1979, so it's been a long time, but still it's great stories. But what that brought me, my dad, you know, died very early, so it wasn't like a silver spoon or anything else. I struggled for everything I have in life, and I taught my kids those values, but it is the Kavanaugh name, which, you know, there's never been an FBI probe in the 60 years of dedicated history in my family's name. I guess they say politics is in your blood. The bug didn't hit me till I was 40, but it's pretty exciting that you can make a difference in people who are struggling, people that have lost faith in government, you know, those without a voice.
Redford Township Democratic Representative Phil Cavanaugh now running for the office of Wayne County Executive. Thanks so much for talking with us, Representative.
Cindy, I greatly appreciate it. Enjoy your day.
The spotlight of the Detroit bankruptcy struggle is widening, from the DIA to the retirees and now to water. Today, a committee of the Oakland County Board of Commissioners voted to spend $500,000 to hire consultants to look into creating a separate water system for Oakland and Macomb counties. It's one more sign of the increasingly tense bargaining between emergency manager Kevin Orr and representatives of Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties all over the future of the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes joins us. And this is something that could really hit a lot of people square in the wallet, people who live well beyond Detroit city limits.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They've got about 4 million customers, which it was pointed out to me is about 40% of the population in the entire state of Michigan. So a lot of people do have an interest in how these negotiations play out. And Kevin Orr is firing back to these allegations that they haven't shared enough information with him with a long laundry list. It's 3 pages of meetings that have been held and about 2.5 pages of listing documents that have been shared with the counties over this thing. They had another meeting earlier this week, and according to Oakland County, nothing was really accomplished. And so there they are back in their corners. Mm. Meanwhile, Kevin Orr has put out what's called a request for information and has gotten 41 responses from potential private water operators around the country. So we're heading down several tracks here, and a lot of us have an interest in how this ends up.
Recap for us, Daniel, exactly what Kevin Orr proposed for the WSD.
He proposed a creation of what they were calling the Great Lakes Water Authority, which would be overseen by a board, a regional authority appointed by Wayne, Oakland, Macomb counties, Detroit. The counties would actually have a majority on the board, but the real sticking point is the amount of money that the counties would be paying the city in leases. Now, Kevin Orr makes the argument that this is revenue neutral and that they wouldn't be paying more. The counties say we don't agree with that, and plus the fact that you have major delinquency problems, particularly in the city of Detroit, and therefore people in the suburbs would be subsidizing people in the city of Detroit who don't pay their bills.
And I had a meeting with Kevin Orr yesterday, and we talked about this, and he acknowledges that those are legitimate concerns.
Mm-hmm.
But he also makes the argument that this is revenue neutral, and this is his preferred solution. But I don't see right now that the counties are willing to move ahead with this in a way that they can see a resolution coming.
And the counties have been complaining, well, they're not giving us the information we want, and the city won't work with us. And that's what the point of Orr's letter was?
Right, and he's basically saying, look, we've given you stuff as it's become available. The counties have made the point, you didn't give us your comprehensive annual financial report, which is annually done by localities. They gave it to them when it was finished. There's one other report he says is clearly still outstanding. He acknowledges that. But he's trying to make the point that they've shared information here. Now, I don't think it profits us to get into this back and forth, aside from the fact to acknowledge that that's what's going on here, is it's backing and forthing, and this is a very high-stakes negotiation. And it's very important to note here that there are political implications for the counties with their own constituents in terms of how these negotiations play out. As long as Detroit controls the water department, and they can always offload the political flack for that, and then point to the city of Detroit and say they're running it, not us.
That's
but
true.
Once the authority has real skin in the game, then that situation changes, and then they can be held more directly accountable to their members. The other thing that's important to note here is I think particularly Macomb and Oakland counties, Oakland particularly, are very fiscally responsible and are run very well. And they're asking some very hard questions of a system that has not been run well for a very, very long time.
Fair questions, yes?
Fair questions. And those things are very hard to square because these are very penetrating and they're hard-nosed. Brooks Patterson's negotiators are very hard-nosed people that understand their numbers and they're pushing things. And so you have really a clash of Brooks Patterson's people and Mark Hackle's people in Macomb County against some very savvy investment bankers and restructuring people that work for Kevin Orr's team.
So if we wind up not getting this regional authority and some private entity takes it over, what could that mean for the shower that I want to take or the grass that I want to water?
I don't think we really know. I mean, I think there's a feeling that we would be more captive to a private operator. Some people say, well, just let the city of Detroit operate it. I think the problem there is that you don't get any kind of revenue or any kind of additional value out of the water department. And what Kevin Orr is trying to do is create value. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reasons that the counties are balking, is saying, you know, we're already ratepayers. Why do we have to pay an additional lease on top of that? And that may be is a fair point. And I think what he would say is in exchange you get more control and there's more investment that is put into the capital improvements of a system that's badly undercapitalized and needs more maintenance. So I think this is going to be a large battle. In fact, we have a number of battles that are playing out here. And some people tell you that in a bankruptcy, the louder people squawk is directly proportional to how close they are to a deal. So you're seeing on the DIA front, you're seeing people really making a lot of noise, asking for 100 years worth of records, because I think they're realizing that they're starting to run out of runway here.
Yeah.
And they're looking at a calendar for the court that is getting closer and closer and closer.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our Thursday check-in. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Well, the Detroit Tigers weren't the only ones to hold an opening day. The Great Lakes shipping season officially opened on March 25th. And unlike opening day at Comerica Park, this one was much less well attended. No surprise, the near total ice coverage on the Great Lakes has led to a very slow start to the shipping season and a whole lot of ice cutting for the U.S. Coast Guard. Mark Gill is the Director of Vessel Traffic Services for the U.S. Coast Guard in Sault Ste. Marie. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, happy to be here, and thank you for telling our story. It's important.
It is good for people to realize, you know, we've all heard of the Sioux Locks, but you know, we think of it maybe as part of Michigan's tourism, but this is so essential for commerce, industry, and the economy.
That's correct. Not many people know, but 3% of the country's GDP passes through the locks each year. And so you think 3%, not a big deal, but you're talking hundreds of billions of dollars of commodities and then production come off of that and hundreds of thousands of jobs that are tied to it.
So we know the Sulaks opened on March 25th. How many commercial ships have made it through so far?
Unfortunately, none. We are currently moving the first two downbounders out of Lake Superior at the present moment. We've been in a form of a convoy movement since last Wednesday. Ice, as you announced, is thick and wide and vast. Out of the Sault Ste. Marie office, we manage the ice breaking for the northern half of Lake Huron, all of Lake Michigan, and all of Lake Superior. And this has been a historic year. 2014 will go down as the most ice coverage that we've had in 35 years. Although the record is relatively young, and we've only been keeping track of it for 35 years. So
Sure. It's
the most we've had since we started recording this. A lot of the seasoned veterans out here on the fleet on the commercial side are telling us this is the most they've seen since the middle 70s. So,
wow.
The ice that we're in Lake Superior, very challenging. Plate thicknesses upwards of 40 inches, about 18 inches of hard-packed snow on type. And then what is not unique but becomes a challenge is those plates break apart and then stack on top of one another. And that stackable ice we call windrows. And the windrows, they're stretching from shoreline to shoreline, and they're every bit of 14 to 16 feet thick.
That is amazing.
That's Arctic breaker type stuff. And although we have advanced equipment in our fleet, they're not designed for that type of ice.
What industries would tend to be most affected by these shipping delays?
Well, the big deal right now, we have two commodities that are really at high demand. You have the iron ore, which goes to the steel facilities, and then you have coal for power plant production. And they're the top priorities right now. Normally, these facilities are able to stockpile or at least have enough on the pier that they can draw from to keep themselves active, you know, when traffic is struggling. But this year, because the fall, we had ice so early and so challenging, the delays to shipping left many of the facilities without necessary supplies. So they draw on those during the winter months and then open the spring and they're ready for just-in-time delivery. Well, the fall was late because of the delays, and now the spring is late because of delays. These iron ore facilities, these steel facilities are desperate, and then also are the power plants. So that's the two hot commodities that we're trying to push right now. So lots of demand. Unfortunately, the conditions are such that we can only address one demand at a time. And so our number one focus right now is to get these two down. And then once we get this supply chain running, we can address some of the other areas too.
How long do you think, what's your best guess before this ice is gone and shipping conditions get back to normal?
Well, there's two answers into that question. So how long will the ice last? I can see us breaking ice into May. It wouldn't surprise me that we're still chasing big ice in the open lakes close to Memorial Day. I hope that's not the case.
Wow.
But based on the weather forecast and what we're seeing, we're going to remain cool up here well into the end of April. And if that's the case, there could still be some free-floating ice around that we need to chase down. So it's not out of the realm of possibilities to be breaking ice into late May or even into early June, for that matter. As far as restoration of traffic, the shipping industry here is they're powerful. I see us having hindered operations, convoys here for the next couple of weeks, and then as time and traffic starts to move, that also adds to the deterioration of to the ice. So I will see with every passing convoy, you'll gain some efficiencies. And with some good fortune and good weather, maybe by the week of the 21st of April, we'll start to see where we're having two-way traffic moving with some efficiency.
We've been talking to Mark Gill, Director of Vessel Traffic Services for the Coast Guard. Thank you so much, Mark. It was great talking with you.
Thank you for carrying our story for the folks out there to understand what the shipping industry means for the Great Lakes, but also helping to tell our story. We appreciate that, and thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.